Okay, so last time, there are some sheets floating around, but not many. So if you want, then follow over somebody else's shoulder. Last time, we started to talk about the underpinnings of the idea of interpreting parts of Tanakh, in particular Chumash, in ways other than the obvious literal meaning of the Psukim. This is something that obviously takes a lot of, it's kind of heady. Once you start to do that, trying to figure out trying to figure out when you're going to do that, when you're not going to do that. So we look to the Rishonim to find what the rules for something like this might be, and we found at least four Rishonim that talk about this: Rav Sadia Gaon, the Rambam, the Shuta Rashba, and even the Ramban, and we also saw the Meiri. I'll just run through all of them quickly without looking at them inside. Rav Sadia Gaon gave us four situations where it would be, I don't know if he means reasonable or even actually obligatory, to read the Psukim in a non-literal fashion. Non-literal over here means you wouldn't translate the words directly from Hebrew, I don't know, Hebrew to English, but you wouldn't understand the words exactly as they are written to be literally true. And the four cases that he gave were, number one, if it contradicts what your senses tell you. And the example of that he gave, which we thought kind of was I don't know, a little bit fanciful, a little strange why anybody would ever think that this would be the way to read the Pasuk, was where the Torah says that Eve was called Chava ki hi em kol chai. And, a literalist, a very literalist reading of this Pasuk would mean that Chava was the mother of donkeys and cows and all kinds, and ants, and obviously that's not true. So Rav Sadia Gaon says, that's obviously not true, it obviously only means that she's the mother of all of mankind. So that was one example. Another one was where the literal sense may be neglect, and it may be against reason. And the example that he gave of that was when God is described as being a fire. So we don't know much about God, but we know that he's not simply a fire. So what it must mean is that he has qualities about him that are like the qualities of fire. And that is a non-literal reading of that pasuk. Another case may be if it contradicts another pasuk. So you're going to have to find one pasuk that you're going to pick as the real one. And the other one needs to be interpreted metaphorically or non-literally. And another case, and this I guess is a big deal, is where a rabbinic tradition attached a reservation to interpreting it literally. I think the best examples of that we came up with last time, usually in terms of halakha, were things like ayin tachat ayin and lifnei iver lo titen michshol and things like that, where the psukim are meant to be interpreted non-literally, even though the literal interpretation actually would make sense. There's nothing wrong with the literal interpretation, but because Chazal say this is what it means, then that's what it means. So they had the ability to do that based on presumably oral tradition or hermeneutic principles. We don't know. It depends on the case. And therefore, in those cases, the pasuk should be interpreted non-literally. I would quibble with that last one, by the way, just in terms of the rule. There is a rule called in mikra yotze midei pshuto, which means that the pasuk should always have its pshat meaning. So even with regards to rabbinic traditions, there is room to say that while the halacha, for example, ayin tachat ayin definitely means you pay for the eye, it may still be the case that on some level it literally means an eye for an eye, but we don't actually implement that lahalacha. How that would actually be played out is an interesting question. The Rav actually suggests something along those lines when he's talking about in Kol Dodi Dofek. He says that while lahalacha ayin tachat ayin means money, with regards to politically how the state of Israel should function, it should be in an ayin tachat ayin fashion. In other words, if an enemy comes out against us, we should respond proportionally, and even maybe even more. And we should, if they take out our eye, we take out their eye. But that's not a halachic statement. That's more of a homiletic statement. And I don't know whether he means to say that that's how we should read the pasuk. It is what he says. So that's Rav Sadia Gaon. We saw the Rambam. The Rambam's basic idea was, and this Rambam is often misquoted. I'll put it this way. He puts forth two theories that existed in ancient times before him, 1,000 years before the Rambam. Aristotle and Plato had two competing theories about the universe. They both agreed that the universe has always existed. That's what Aristotle and Plato both said. But Aristotle said the universe has always existed because God has always existed, and the universe is just an extension, an outgrowth of God, and that's it. And so because of that, the universe can't change. There are no miracles because it's just emanating from God. And Plato believed that the universe always existed, stam, because it just did, and there is a God, but the universe can change. And the Rambam said, Aristotle's viewpoint we reject categorically, and even if Aristotle were to prove that it was true, we would still reject it categorically, because it contradicts a fundamental faith principle, the idea that God created the world out of his free will, and that he changes the world and there are miracles, and then the world can change. That it can change, that there can be miracles. However, Plato's principle, that the universe is eternal, while we don't believe it, he says, if Plato were to prove it to be true, I would reinterpret Psukim in Torah in order to accord with that theory. Because I don't think that it contradicts any fundamental tenets of the Jewish faith. This is for me and for later. So in other words, you learn two things from the Rambam. Number one, you learn that he is willing to reinterpret Torah if there is some kind of scientific or philosophical principle that is proven, as long as it still fits within the tenets of Judaism. However, if it's outside, if it's completely contradicts what we know about God and the world, according to Judaism, then he would not actually accept it into valid Jewish thought, and he would not reread the scriptural text in order to accord with that. That's the Rambam. So it goes kind of both ways.
What would give him the right to do that?
Which one?
Plato. What would give him the right? If Plato would
to accept
prove,
Plato.
To prove.
Because he says, if it's right, it's right. If it's true, if it's proven, sufficiently proven, then why not? Why not say, okay, you know what? The Torah can fit with that, and therefore we'll try to make the Torah fit with that. Why would he go against something that was proven to be true? Obviously, the word prove here means different things in different eras, right? But when we get to our era, we have things that we would use the word proof for, and we're going to have to contend with them. Okay? So for the Rambam, that was, you know, philosophical, metaphysical proofs, those were real. They're not as real to us. Whether that means they're not real at all, I don't know. But we just don't talk in those terms anymore. Then we saw the Rashba, which is a surprising one to see, because the Rashba comes from a different school from the Rambam, not as as reverent about science and nature as one might think the Rambam is. But nevertheless, the Rashba did acknowledge that if something similar to the Rambam, if something could be fit into Torah, if it doesn't contradict Torah, and there's no Kabbalah against it, science wins. In other words, a nice interpretation of Torah versus science, which can be brought in line with Torah, science will win. However, a traditional interpretation of the Torah, namely something that Chazal say, this is what the words mean, versus science, the traditional interpretation of the Torah will win. And he'll say, I get it. I get science. He says, if we didn't have Torah, then I would just go science all the way. I understand. You know, these are good. It's good things. Philosophy is good. Science is good. Proofs are good. It's just that Torah is better. And so if we have interpretations that are necessary traditionally, very similar to Rav Saadia Gaon's fourth idea, then we should take the Torah's, then we should take the oral tradition interpretation. But if we don't, then there is room to accept philosopher and science critiques in order to understand the Torah. Okay? And one actual, just one implementation of that is actually his Rebbe, the Ramban, does that. We saw that the Ramban, in his at first blush, when he looks at the keshet, the rainbow of the Noach story, at first blush, his reading of the Psukim is that God invented the rainbow after the flood. That was the first time it ever happened, and God invented it at that moment. It didn't exist beforehand, and it was implemented at that moment. But then he says, but what are we going to do? The Greeks have shown how there is a scientific explanation for the rainbow, for the refraction of the light through mist and the clouds in the background and all this. We understand what the rainbow is and was and always has been. And he says, and what are we going to do? We have to accept the explanation of the Greeks. They're right. And since we have to accept it, he then goes back and rereads the Psukim and Torah. Now, in the end, the interpretation that he comes up with, it almost feels like he's more satisfied with it than his initial interpretation. You want to go back and look at it inside again? You can. His second interpretation, which is motivated and influenced by the Greeks, he's happy with it. He says, this actually makes more sense than what I said initially. But the fact that he had to go back and do that, or that he was even willing to mention the Greeks, is telling. This is almost, you know, a live case of what the Rashba was talking about, where there was an interpretation, it wasn't something that he was married to, and then when he got more information from science, he said, okay, you know what, let's go back and look at that again, we can make more sense of it now.
Kashtina Tati, that was the pasuk he used, right?
Yeah.
Kashtina Tati existed before, it just...
Yeah, because he said Natati, as opposed to attain or notain or present or future. He said Natati, that it always was there. Don't say amen on the tape.
Something that I took as a given in school was I was taught that the Rishonim, like Rashi, the Perush on the Torah, when we used to ask in school, how does he know? They tell us that he had Ruach HaKodesh.
Rashi?
Yeah.
Most of the time it's just Midrashim. Rashi almost always just quotes Midrashim. Almost, I would say 90 to 95% of Rashi is Midrash. It's very rare that he'll make his own comment. Very rare.
I think to say that Rashi or others at Ruach Kodesh is a convenient way of dealing deeper into
it. Would you corroborate with that?
What? With what?
The fact that Rashi...
did Rashi have Ruach Kodesh? I don't know. Okay. I don't know Rashi.
Okay, but some of the Nevi'im
Navi had Nevuah, and right, they may have also had Ruach HaKodesh.
But the basis for the Rambam.
That what?
The way that he reached his understandings was merely by just logic, philosophy, understanding, learning, or was there anything?
I don't know. I wasn't there. I assume that's what the Rambam thought. Although, I mean,
are there any writings? Let me make my question clearer. Are there any writings of Perushim that we have that we know that were written with Ruach HaKodesh,
There are definitely writings that some people have said were written Ruach HaKodesh. I don't know how you would know if it was written Ruach HaKodesh. I don't know what the litmus test for that would be. Okay. If you trust people who say that it was written Ruach HaKodesh, then it was written Ruach HaKodesh. If you have no reason to trust them, yes or no, then it's up in the air. I assume what we mean by it was written Ruach HaKodesh means God helped him write this parish and directed him towards. I certainly believe that in general that God helps people, come to write Perushim. I don't know when, yes, when no.
The Chamisha Chamshei Torah.
Yeah.
Was written
by Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah.
By Moshe, but divinely with Hashem's help.
Yeah. Dictated by God.
Sorry.
Dictated by God.
Nevi'im and Ksuvim.
Right. So that's written b'nevuah. So Hashem gives Yirmiyahu a nevuah, and Yirmiyahu writes it down.
Okay. And then after that, the Mishnayos, Gemaras. This is already no longer with
this is oral tradition. This is oral traditions that were written down. How much divine intervention was there is a subject of machshava.
They talk about things.
That's true.
So, basis of that, we understand the philosophies of
the most prominent baskol is rejected because it's a baskol. Meaning, in the Gemara, they stop being so about a baskol.
So I'm just trying to understand the basis for the logic behind the Rambam, the Rashba.
I'm not sure what that has to do with this.
I tell you what, because if they are being guided divinely,
Yonah was right.
I want to know whether there's any divine intervention in the way that they're writing, in the same way that Shema Yisrael Bamidbar has divine intervention, or is it simple? It's their own intellectual philosophy and logic.
So,
we call the Arachaim HaKodesh.
Yeah.
The Rambam is not called Kodesh, but I think anybody who's read his material would think that he's pretty Kodesh.
Right.
Right. So.
I don't really have a great answer. It sounds like what you're asking is, do we have to believe that the Rambam is right in everything that he says?
No, I'm not sure.
Or maybe a weaker version of, do we have to believe that the Rambam was occasionally helped by God when he was writing his parish?
And therefore, we have to accept what he said.
I think that's a reasonable thing to say. But how do you know that he was right about everything? For example, What can you do? There are things that the Rambam wrote which were scientifically inaccurate.
Right.
If you look in his Sefer Yesodei HaTorah, descriptions about the planets and what they are, he believed that the planets were alive, that they were sentient. Because that's what everybody believed at the time. They believed in spontaneous generation of lice. He believed in certain kinds of animals that, look, as far as we know, never existed.
They believed in ghosts.
Whatever they believed in. So, you know, but that doesn't say, you know, one way or another about all of the writings that they had. It's a hard thing. Do I believe that some writers had connection to something spiritual when they were writing, and they were writing about things that in a way that I'll give you an example. Okay? Give me an example. The Ravid has a huge argument with the Rambam about something very, very near and dear to us, the Beit HaMikdash. They argue about whether or not the Har HaBayit retains its Kedusha to the degree that walking on it is a Chiyuv Karet. Look, Rambam definitely writes that walking in the wrong spot at Har HaBayit, Chiyuv Karet. The Ravid, some debate about what exactly he meant. He definitely says there's no Chiyuv Karet. He probably doesn't say it's Mutter. He probably says it's Aser, but it's no Chiyuv Karet. At the end of the Ravid's comment over there, he says, Sod Hashem li Re'av, which means the secret of Hashem is given over to the ones who are afraid of him. Which appears to be the Ravid saying, I know this from Ruach HaKodesh. That's the Ravid saying about his own comment, I know this because of my Ruach HaKodesh. It sounds like that's what he's saying. Okay. Sounds like it. For the most part, we don't pass on like the Ravid. Doesn't seem like it. I mean, people are worried about Karyas and Harabayas. We generally follow the Rambam on this point. So what do we do? He just said he had Ruach HaKodesh, and we follow the Rambam. That says more about the legal process than it does about Ruach HaKodesh. Getting back to your point about Rashi, though, right?
It's about all of these. The Rambam, the Meiri, the Rambam.
Yeah, but not about these specific points. Here, right now, we're evaluating their arguments.
No, I'm more about how we are supposed to relate to what they're saying.
In these specific cases?
I don't know what these specific cases are, but as far as their ability to be able to mafarish the Torah and what we and their philosophies about life.
I don't think you have to accord them Ruach HaKodesh to give them the authority to tell us, or at least to give us Ayesh Almin Lismoch, to, in this case, interpret the Torah in some situations as being allegorical and not literal. They don't need Ruach HaKodesh to do that. They're the Rambam, the Ramban, the Rashba. They're all we have, right? Okay. Rashi didn't write systematically about his Perush on the Chumash, so we don't know what Rashi would say about these things. We only know his Perushim. The Rambam wrote systematically. He would say, this is what I am doing. This is how I think this should work. Right? The Ramban wrote systematically. This is how I think the Torah was written. This is how we should interpret it. So they gave us the tools. They don't need any other. They don't need Ruach HaKodesh to be able to tell us that, because, frankly, they're all we have. They are the Baalei Mesorah. Whether God helped them along, I hope so. I think so.
What do you mean by Ruach HaKodesh? You mean that God directed the decision making,
the writings? They told them what to
then when they wrote it. So to the degree God kind of directed them to write this.
The kind of lower level of Nevi'im.
Unconsciously, like subconsciously, or consciously.
The Nevi'im wrote based on.
I don't think you need that.
So,
I don't think you need that.
So, are you saying that you're differentiating halakha to philosophical understanding because halakha doesn't make a difference so much as philosophical understanding is more important?
I think philosophical understanding is like the much bigger
macro picture. Why do you need for this and say not for deciding halakha?
Maybe you do. That wasn't
maybe
my question.
Do.
I'm sure you
You definitely don't.
I think you need some kind of. It's based on
the halakha process.
All the principles of Gezeirah, all other principles that we base the halakha on are the
Shloshei Midos are traditionally passed down from Moshe at Har Sinai.
Right.
Not Ruach HaKodesh.
From Moshe is not Ruach HaKodesh.
They were given to Moshe to be implemented scientifically, so to speak, by the Chachamim. I mean, that's what it is.
I mean. Yeah, but there's a difference between halakha, which is definitely.
I'm sorry if I'm diverting here, but did Rebbe learn with Eliyahu HaNavi physically? Is this an appropriate question to ask?
Well, let me flip it around on you, all right? And we'll go 1,000 years in the future. There's a famous story about the Vilna Gaon, which is recorded in the Nefesh Chaim, as far as I know. I think so. It's definitely in my version of Nefesh Chaim, which it might be at the back over there with like biographical information. There's a famous story that Rav Chaim of Elezion used to say that we know, for example, here are two diametrically opposed stories. Rav Yosef Karo wrote several books. One of the books that he wrote was called Magid Meisharim. Magid Meisharim. Rav Yosef Karo is the author of the Shulchan Aruch, Kesef Mishnah, the Beit Yosef. Magid Meisharim is basically his recordings of his conversations with a malach, who gave him interpretations of the Torah. Okay? Now, contrast that with the story about the Vilna Gaon, who apparently, every time he would sit down to learn and to write down his chidushim, every once in a while he would be visited by a malach who wanted to learn and to teach him, and he would kick him out. He'd say, I don't want you here. I'm doing this on my own. I don't want your help. I want my interpretations to be pure and coming from my own mind. You're just going to sully it, and you're going to make my learning worth less because, you know, if I'm learning with you, then that makes it less special. That's the story they tell about the Vilna Gaon. Whether it happened or not, I have no idea. But the point is that halacha does, to a certain degree, ignore Ruach HaKodesh. The Gemara itself says, "Ein avi rishay l'chadesh davar." Even through a nevuah, he cannot give you a new interpretation of Torah. He cannot give you a new halacha, a new mitzvah. He can give you interpretation, but he can't give you a new thing. So it's very much based on Sanhedrin, based on interpretations and logic, which is why sometimes it can be varied. The Ramban writes about halacha. This is a different topic. The Ramban writes in his Sefer Milchamos Hashem, he points out, how come there's so many arguments? I'm arguing. He wrote a sefer called Milchamot Hashem. You know what Milchamot Hashem was? It was a counter argument to the sefer Baal HaMa'or, which was an argument against the Rif. The Rif was, you know, the big daddy. He wrote a book of halacha, which is, you know, goes according to the Gemara. The sefer Baal HaMa'or of Zachia Levi, he wrote a critique basically on the Rif, and then the Ramban comes and defends the Rif against the Baal HaMa'or. And at the beginning, the Ramban is like, what is this? Like, what's going on? How come I'm defending and arguing? Why is there always arguments about everything? If you ever open up like a Ktos and a Nesivos, they always argue. How could it be that they argue about everything? How could it be that on no single point that they can just agree? So the Ramban says, because halacha, I'm sorry to say, is not science and it's not math. There is not any, there is no absolute answer. You ask a math question, 2 plus 2 equals, there's no world where it's equal to 5. It doesn't exist. It can't be. Halakha is not like that, though, because you can move the variables around a little bit, and you can come up, theoretically, with a different answer within the rules. The Gemara says there are 49 ways to make something tahor, 49 ways to make something tameh. This is not to make a joke out of halakha. You need to be completely suffused in order to be able to do this kind of thing. You can't just make things up. However, it means that to a certain degree, when we say there's no Ruach HaKodesh, maybe the reason there's no Ruach HaKodesh in halakha is because Ruach HaKodesh implies that there's one right answer. And between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Adi Yosef, who has the Ruach HaKodesh? I don't want to play that game. I'd rather read their arguments. And, you know, if I feel sufficiently qualified, evaluate them and choose. And the choice may be based on a bunch of different factors, but it's not going to be based on who I think had a closer connection to God or who might have been influenced by God more. I don't think.
A lot of people wouldn't agree with the last thing you said, but that's fun.
Okay.
But it is very important how Kodesh the person is.
Was that
Kodesh?
You asked about Rabbi and Eliyahu and Navi. I don't know anything about Rabbi learning with Eliyahu and Navi. I don't know anything about Rabbi and Eliyahu and Navi.
No. This is what you said is much better about, you know, you brought two polar opposites and with Malachim.
Look, the more Kabbalistic you get, the more you're going to ask the Malachim for help.
Nobody's arguing whether the Malach actually turned up. We know that the Malach turned up to learn with him. He just said, I don't want to learn with you, buddy.
Yeah, I think so. And this was the argument in the Gemara in Baba Metzia about Tanur Shel Achnai, right? Rabbi Yehoshua versus Rabbi Eliezer. Eliezer gets a bas kol to come out in his favor, and Rabbi Yehoshua yells out and says, "Lo b'shamayim." Now, what exactly that means is hard to, you know. There's a maral about that, but it definitely gives you the impression that they were ignoring a bas kol. That's the impression that you get. That's a simple meaning of the Gemara.
Not only that's not the impression, that's the halakha. So is that if you hear a bus call,
right,
you ignore it.
So I'll tell you the alternative, though, what the Maharal says about that. The Maharal says, well, what was the bus call saying? If you actually look in the Gemara, remember what the bus call actually said?
Yes.
Just remind you what happened, right? There's an argument about Tanur Shel Achnai, about whether it's Tameh or if it's Tahor. Rabbi Yeshua, I don't remember which side, who takes which side, Rabbi Yeshua or Rabbi Lezer. Somehow in the whole argument, that takes a backseat. But basically, I think actually I do know the answer, because I think they broke the Tanurim, which means that they must have been Tamei, so Rabbi Yeshua took the Tamei. I'm going to go on a limb and say Rabbi Yeshua and the Chachamim said it was Tamei, and Rabbi Elazar said it was Tahor, and that's why they broke all of the ovens afterwards. So I think that's right. So what happens? So Rabbi Elazar says, I'm right. They say that they're right. The majority says that they're right. And Rabbi Elazar calls upon all these miracles to happen, including a bas kol to confirm him. Now, at the end, what does the bas kol actually say? Now, what would you want the bas kol to say?
It is
halacha ker Rabbi Elazar.
In this case, right?
Yeah.
You would want the bas kol to either say a tanur tahor, or to say something like Rabbi Elazar is right, something like that. What does the bas kol actually say? The bas kol actually says halacha ker Rabbi Elazar b'kol davar. Called Davar, or called Makom, or called Zman, whatever it is. Which is another way of saying, Rabbi Lazar is really smart, and I like him, and he's always right. But saying he's always right is, there's something lacking over here. There's something, that's not what we asked. We asked, who's right in this situation? We didn't ask, who's right more often, or who's right always right. So the Maharal says over there, what the Baskel was saying is that Hashem likes Rabbi Elazar because he's pious, and he's brilliant, and he's devoted to God, and that's what it means. But it's that versus the majority. And when it's the majority versus who Hashem likes better, majority wins. That's how the Maharal reads the Gemara. It's one reading of the Gemara. But either way, you come out with the Baskel not winning. So that's the upshot over there. Okay, now, let's go a little bit further. I want to get into a couple of specific cases. I know we were going to talk about Noach and the Teva, but before we get there, we have to get through Bereishit first, right? So here's a question. Was there a Garden of Eden? That's test number one of this whole theory. All right, so I'm on that page, which says test number one. Was there a Garden of Eden?
Of course not.
Was there an actual Garden of Eden? Strange question?
Yeah.
Why?
There's a GPS that says exactly where it is.
Okay.
It's in the middle of Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
Where Nahal Pat and Hidekel, they're all there.
On the GPS, can you see the angels with the flaming swords?
It was, I don't know what the interpretation was. It could be
the Ramban says it's in Africa somewhere.
I think
he says it's in Africa somewhere.
No.
He says everybody knows.
Right.
That's what he writes. He says everybody knows it's in Africa.
How come it's in Africa?
That's what he said. I don't know. You're clear.
And, it's all in Saudi Arabia.
Ramban in the Shar Gemal.
Where is those?
I think Malom Bereshit is
It sounds ridiculous. I don't think the story sounds ridiculous.
No, why would they be banished from a physical place that exists in the world today?
They make too much noise.
Let's say Yoel was right, and let's say there was a blackout. Let's say there's a blackout. Would that make the story ridiculous? I don't think so. I think the story would be perfectly reasonable.
It's a great story.
What makes the story unbelievable, David? That's what I'm asking. What makes the story not believable to you?
To me? Obviously there's a whole range of things we're talking about at the beginning of creation that are completely unbelievable. Not unbelievable, but from a practical perspective, whether that actually happened or not.
No, be specific. Don't just say it.
The creation story.
What's unbelievable about the creation story?
There's many things that don't make sense that can be interpreted that lead you to what to...
No, not many things. What doesn't make sense?
Separation of light and the day.
What's unbelievable about separation of light and of light and dark?
Light and darkness that exists before a day.
What's unbelievable about that?
I think the whole...
When you say unbelievable, I assume that what you mean is it does not accord with our scientific version of the way that the world came to be. That doesn't make it unbelievable. It just makes it inaccurate. Something that would be unbelievable would be, for example, a woman naturally had a child without actually ever, having a relationship with a man. That would be unbelievable.
Taking a bone from a man and then creating a woman.
Okay, so that's the part that you think is unbelievable. In other words, because you think it sounds like a fairy tale.
The whole thing sounds like...
The idea of man...
It's not meant to sound real.
Okay.
I don't think any of it's meant to sound real. It's all.
So when you read the story, let's get specific. Like the part about Chava being taken from the bone of man sounds like a faith. It sounds like a myth. It sounds like a fable more than it sounds like a real accurate story.
Connected and split, the heavens and the earth together.
I don't know why that's unbelievable.
How else did we create the world?
It would make you feel better if it started talking about, you know, little tiny things splitting, and then there was this big explosion, and that would be believable. I mean, first of all, if you lived 2,000 years ago, would that be believable to you? If it started describing how there was this tiny little thing, and then out of nowhere it just exploded, and everything, and then there were these animals, and then over time they changed and they became other animals, that would be believable to you? No, if you lived 2,000 years ago, you would say, this is a stupid story. This makes no sense.
Day one, this happening. It sounds too stupid.
No, but it's
day
not.
Day one, this happens.
But we know that.
Day
one isn't day one, and day two.
Say it, or we're not there yet. We're not there yet. But I don't think.
This seems to be written in a poetic way that we're meant to understand different things from it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it literally has to have happened.
That's the feeling that you get.
Yeah,
okay, fine. Okay, but let's get past the creation story. Maybe we'll return to it.
To this story,
to the Garden of Eden.
The Garden of Eden, the banished from this place. Also, it's very spiritualistic rather than very.
Doesn't sound spiritual to me, but okay.
No, you live in this place. But it's banished from this place. Why?
Yeah, God never banishes people from anywhere.
No, but it doesn't make sense. If you banish from a physical entity, why?
You mean like from Eretz Israel?
No, but Eretz Israel was a place that we were taken to live in. It was a place that we went to.
Are you listening? Are you listening?
I always looked upon the story of the Garden.
You know that the Ramban actually says the whole point of the story about Adam and Chava and the story about Noach is actually teaching the principle of banishment, which is something that, you know, repeatedly happens and then eventually happens to us, and it's kind of like teaching that lesson.
I just never believed that it was a true story. It doesn't make a difference to me. Never sounded like a true story.
Fine. So let's see if anybody follows David. So let's take a look at the Rambam. Okay? Rambam and the Mor Nevuchim. Let's see what he says. He says, consider the difficulty in the statement that time existed before the creation of the sun. We shall undoubtedly soon remove this difficulty. All things were created together, but were separated from each other successively. What did the Rambam just say? What did the Rambam just say?
You need to read it backwards maybe to understand it.
Well, let's look at that last part. All things were created together but were separated from each other successively. What does that mean? It sounds like he's saying that everything was created all at once.
Is that the simple understanding
that you get when you read the Torah? I mean, the word bara shows up a lot of times over the course of 7 days. Right. But it's not. The Rambam is describing something that sounds a little bit different than the way that the Torah describes it.
Big
Bang? No, we go back to the Keshet. You know, there's a Midrash says that everything was brought in the world when the world was created. And then Hashem showed us the Keshet when it was time to be revealed.
Well, let's take a look at what he says the rest of the time. The account of the 6 days of creation contains, in reference to the creation of man, the statement, male and female created them, and concludes with the words, thus the heaven and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And yet, the portion which follows describes the creation of Eve from Adam, the tree of life, the tree of knowledge, the history of the serpent, the events connected herewith, and all this as having taken place after Adam had been placed in the Garden of Eden. What's the problem? What's the Rambam pointing out? In chapter 1, man is created with woman, right? Zachar unukeva. And in the second story, right, in chapter 2, chapter 3 rather, Adam is placed, first of all, already made in Gan Eden. And then Chava is pulled out of it.
The Midrash and Asira, it's a known Midrash. They were born back to back.
That's a nice Midrash, but that's not what the Torah says.
What? Why?
It's not what the Torah said. It doesn't say anything about it.
They were created together, man and woman.
Yes.
And then afterwards, they refer to Adam by himself.
Yes, that's the problem.
That's
a problem.
Right.
Why?
And
there's a problem here. Come on. There's a problem. Acknowledge that there's a problem.
What's the problem?
I know that the Midrash has a solution, but there's a problem. Acknowledge that there's a problem.
Okay, fine.
All our sages agree that this took place in the sixth day, and nothing new was created after the close of the 6 days. None of the things mentioned above is therefore impossible, because the laws of nature were that not yet permanently fixed. There are, however, some utterances of our sages on this subject, which imply a different view. I will gather them from their different sources and place them before you, and I will refer also to certain things by mere hints, just as has been done by the sages. Okay, now here's something interesting that the Rambam is saying. Saying, the sages have many interpretations of this. Some of them are about how nature was not yet perfectly fixed. And he says, I'm going to put them in front of you. Now, you must know that their words, which I am about to quote, are most perfect, most accurate, and clear to those for whom they were said. Whose words?
The sages.
The sages. In other words, anything the Rambam is about to talk about right now are statements by the rabbis, and he's saying that they are clear, they are perfect, and they were clear to the ones to whom they were said. Which means that it could be that when they were said to the people that they were said to, they meant something different than what they mean when we read them. Because just like we know that nowadays, if I say something to you in 2018 and somebody reads it in 2058, then they will maybe misunderstand what I said.
Well, they were said in a way that was relevant to the people of that time.
Exactly. I will therefore not add long explanations, lest I make their statements plain, and I might thus become a revealer of secrets. Okay, here is the big line of the Rambam. But I will give them in a certain order. What?
I'm going
to
do it anyway.
No, he's saying I'm not going to go into long explanations because I don't want to become a revealer of secrets, but I will give them in a certain order accompanied with a few remarks which will suffice to readers like you. The following is also a remarkable passage, most absurd in its literal sense. But as an allegory, it contains wonderful wisdom and fully agrees with real facts, as will be found by those who understand all the chapters of this treatise. When the serpent came to Eve, he infected her with poison. The Israelites who stood at Mount Sinai removed that poison. Idolaters who did not stand at Mount Sinai have not got rid of it. Now, okay, this is a midrash. The midrash says the Gemara. It's the Gemara. It's the Gemara in Shabbos. It's the Gemara in Shabbos that says that the serpent infected Chava with a zuama. That's the word that the Gemara uses. Some kind of infection which we know of as the Yetzer Hara. When Bnei Yisrael stood at Har Sinai, they got rid of it. And then when they did Chet Ha'egel, they got it back. The idolaters never actually got rid of it, never got it back, whatever it is. Okay, now this is, right, a midrash. And what the Rambam is saying is that, what is he saying? He's saying it's absurd in its literal sense. It's absurd to believe that the serpent physically infected Chava with something. Right? And so it must mean something metaphorical. Now, is this the words of the sages, or is it the words of the Torah? What he's talking about.
It's not written in the Torah.
No, it's not written in the Torah. So it's the words of the sages. So when the Rambam says it must be understood allegorically, what is he talking about? He's talking about the Midrash, the Gemara, right? Take a look at the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel in the next section says, the Rambam believed that there were not separate creative acts on 6 days, but rather everything was created on one day in a single instant. That was what we saw in the Rambam. What the heck?
Can you explain that?
What is going on here? I've just magnetically connected the cups to my hand. I don't know. It's plastic. Whatever. In the work of creation, there is mention of 6 days to indicate the different levels of created beings according to Abarbanel. The Rambam believed that there were not separate creative acts on 6 days, but rather everything was created on one day in a single instant. In the work of creation, there is mention of 6 days to indicate the different levels of created beings according to their natural hierarchy. Not that there were actual days, and nor that there was a chronological sequence to that which was created in the Acts of Genesis. Now, the Abarbanel just said that the Rambam said that the world was not created in 6 days, but rather was created all at once.
The world or
the
universe?
The world, the universe was created all at once. And when the Torah talks about 6 days, it's talking about the hierarchy. It's giving you a kind of spiritual breakdown, I don't know if spiritual is even the right word for it, it could be a scientific breakdown, of the different aspects of creation. In other words, when it says God created these things in different days, that's just a shorthand for saying, let's separate the reality into 6 different parts. And we'll call them 6 different days, but that's not giving you the chronological order of how God created the world.
It also makes sense, because if you look at the first chapter and a half, whatever, or the Torah, it's the overview of creation, and then he gets into the nitty-gritty in the next three chapters.
But let's acknowledge that that's not what the Torah literally says. The Torah literally says that there were 6 days, and on each day something was created.
Literally.
The Abravanel's understanding, the Abravanel's understanding that the Rambam believes that the Torah didn't mean that, that the Torah really meant that everything was created all at once, and that it was that when the Torah says days, it really is just, it's just a shorthand, it's a poetic way of describing how God structured the world. Okay? Now,
you made it understandable for us because we understand days. So who knows if I don't really
maybe
say that,
maybe.
Say that, also, the first day could have been, thousand years.
Yeah.
Whatever.
It would be the equivalent of when you wanted to, when you want to explain to children math, right? So you're gonna use apples, right? You're going to say 5 apples plus 5 apples, you have 10 apples, right? Now, math doesn't have anything to do with apples. It's just a convenient way of describing. No child is actually going to grow up thinking that math is somehow tied to apples. At a certain point, they figure out math is separate from apples. But when they're that age, that's how they understand. They relate apples to math. We're smart enough to figure out that that's not really what's going on. So too with the Torah. This is how I understand what the Rabbi Manel is saying. He's saying, this is a way for people to process this idea.
Well, go back to what David was saying. Unless you're Jewish and you've brought up to believe that it's true, the whole story is pretty ridiculous. We are trying to apply like a logic to something ridiculous and saying, oh, no, it's ridiculous, but we're going to apply logic to it, so then it's all going to be okay.
Well, the Ramban disagrees with this interpretation. Well, let's go step by step. The Rabbanel says this is what the Ramban means. Did the Rambam actually say this?
What does he say? What point?
He said something. He said that the world was created, the universe was created in a single instant, and then God and then the description is of God separating. Now, if I were reading the Rambam and I took him at his word, then I would have said that the world was created in an instant, and then on each successive day, God separated one thing from another. That's how I would have read the Rambam by myself. The Rabbanel tells us that no, that's not what the Rambam means. The Rambam really means that take the entire thing allegorically. That really the entire story is just a description of the structure of the universe and not of the chronological order of its creation. We're going to have to take the Rabbanel at his word because we don't know what the Rambam really meant. He kind of left it open to interpretation. You should know that the Ramban says black on white that there were 6 days of creation and there were 6 days of 24 hours each.
Who says that?
The Ramban. The Ramban says there were 6 days of 24 hours each of creation. He says that's what you have to believe.
There wasn't time.
Yeah, what was the?
What do you mean there wasn't time? Why wasn't there time?
What was a day?
24 hours.
The sun went up and went down. How did you
is
measure
the sun? Is time tied to the sun?
How do you measure?
I don't know. It's the same way you measure it now, presumably. For now. Let's assume that what the Ramban meant by that was that there were, I don't know, how many chalakim are there in a day?
It depends.
5,000 something, I don't know. Let's assume that's what the Ramban meant for now. Now, is that ridiculous? Personally, I don't think it's ridiculous. We have an issue when we start talking about the age of the universe and what science tells us, but I don't find the story to be ridiculous. I don't think it's ridiculous. Whether or not it accords with what scientists have said, the way that if there was a Big Bang and then everything happens after that, what would have happened? That's a separate question. But it's not ridiculous to me, at least.
It's not ridiculous.
What's not ridiculous?
I don't think it's ridiculous to believe that the world is created in 6 24-hour periods by God. There's nothing
ridiculous.
Why?
What takes 24 hours?
I don't know why he did it that way, but the Torah says he did it that way. I don't know, but that doesn't matter to me. It's not... Torah wants to tell a story like that, and it says this is what happened. I don't see what's ridiculous about that. I could come up with, 4 different drushas about why it would have to be 24 hours and why it had to be the exact same as it is now. I mean, it's not that hard. But, all right, that's what the Ramban says. Now, that's in terms of creation. But now...
Counting of the hours from when man was created until he was banished from Gan Eden. That took about 12 hours. Right?
Yeah, very short time.
Maybe half a day.
That, I mean, that's the Midrash, but
the Rambam and the Barbanel relate to the use of the word Bereshis as opposed to Boracious.
What?
Like we say Bereshis, which means a beginning as opposed to.
Well, we don't know what it means, but okay.
I think it means one of the things that I remember reading is that Bereshis is in a beginning. like there were other, which as one of the explanations is to
have. Rambam doesn't mention anything about prior universes, if that's what you're asking.
Who does?
The Rambam doesn't mention anything
does
about.
Anybody else?
Yeah, the Zohar.
Okay.
The Midrash, yeah.
Okay.
The Rambam doesn't mention anything about that. Isn't that interesting?
I think
the only thing is there's so much allegory in the Torah, as we spoke about the finger, the hand, talking about all these things.
So the Rambam, but everything we saw before said only when it's necessary. Only when it's necessary. So you have to figure out when it's necessary. But let me finish though. So that's what he says. And then he says, this is the view of the Rambam, which he considered as one of the major secrets of creation. He tried to conceal this view with ingenuity, as can be seen in his words there. But Ralbag went and tattled, revealing his secret, as did Narboni and the other commentators. In other words, the Abravanel acknowledges the Rambam didn't say any of this. He didn't say any of this. What he said was cryptic and could be understood in many different ways. And what gets even more severe is the next part, which I didn't put on here. Many understand that according to the Rambam, also the whole story about Adam and Chava didn't happen. Now, did the Rambam write that anywhere? Nowhere did the Rambam write about that at all. In fact, if anything, he wrote differently because he drew conclusions from the story about Adam and Chava about history. And so if anything, he believed that it did happen. But there is this tendency that's called the esotericist viewpoint, which is that whenever the Rambam writes something in the Moreh Nevuchim, you can't trust him. You can't trust him if he writes something. He doesn't really mean it. He really means something else. I've never understood. But but many, many take this viewpoint. So you might as well just say that Abravanel says this, or the Ralbag says this, rather than say the Rambam says this. But this viewpoint... has taken hold. And there are a lot that have attributed to the Rambam this viewpoint that the first 11 chapters, we'll get to Noach in a second, the first 11 chapters of Bereshit are all allegorical. Let's keep it simple for now and say that the first three chapters, right? The story is about Adam and Chava allegorical, the story about Bereshit till the end of Noach. The story about Bereshit is allegorical. Again, I see no evidence in the Rambam for him actually black on white saying this anywhere. I think it's arguable whether or not it fits into his criteria. The Rambam had no knowledge about the age of the universe. There were no dinosaur bones to speak of that they would have bothered him. He had no reason to think that there was anything off about the description of the way that the world was created. No reason to think any of those things. So why would he have actually said this? I don't know.
Contradictions with what he says in different books.
So,
and he has also. So I heard.
He does. He does.
Obviously, he does. That's obvious. But I heard that one of the reasons why Rambam can be interpreted that he doesn't necessarily, although I know you said categorically before that he does believe in creation ex nihilo, but maybe
yes, he does.
He even has an opinion that.
I have no idea what that means. I mean, to say that he has contradictions, so then you deal with the contradictions one by one. But then to say, because he has contradictions, he doesn't mean anything he says, then I don't even know why we're reading the Rambam.
Yeah.
I don't know why. We might as well just write our own books. I don't get it. I just don't get it. I never get it.
Yeah.
I've not seen any, maybe I'm not a scholar, but I have never seen it. If he says something happened, and there's no contradiction somewhere else, then I don't get it. There are things that seem to be contradictions. For example, I'll give you an example. The Rambam writes in one place that the only reason for korbanot is to reject avodah zarah, right? Which leads people to say that it must be that in the future, when we don't need to reject avodah zarah anymore, we won't need korbanot. Now there are two problems with that. One problem is that in the Mishnah Torah he explicitly says that we are going to have korbanot in the future, and the other problem is that if you go further on in the Moreh Nevuchim, he gives other explanations for why there were korbanot. So there you have a contradiction. You have to deal with it. You have to figure out what the Rambam meant. But when he doesn't contradict himself, I just don't get it. Now, if some people said that they spoke to the Rambam, and he told them something different than what he read, then you can talk.
Yeah, the Nazism for the
but these are, that's not what's happening over here. Now, before we get to Noach. Another word about age of the universe stuff. I have here an article, actually, by Dr. David Schatz, which I edited when I was working for Tradition. I got in trouble for something in there, but I won't recount that right now. And it's the article is called "Is There Science in the Bible? An Assessment of Biblical Concordism." What's biblical concordism? Concordism, whatever. The idea being that everything in the Bible must accord with science. Now, let's put it this way. Let's do it systematically. You encounter the fact that the Torah describes 6 days of creation, which, according to the Ramban, means 6 24-hour days, which means that the age of the universe is about 6,000 years. Right? According to the plain, obvious, simple meaning of what the Torah says. Then you encounter the science of the last 200-300 years, which says that the universe is about 15-plus billion years old, and the Earth is something like 75 million years old, something like that, based on all kinds of proofs, from carbon dating to the fossil record, to in terms of the reality, the age of the universe, to, you know, to the distance of stars and light and things like, and the age of light and things like that. Now, what do you do? So you have in front of you a few options. One option, if you live in certain parts of Eretz Yisrael, is to say, science, shmayance. Right? Science, I don't care about science. Now, I have a few things to say about that, but we'll just leave it for now. That's one option, is to say, ignore the science. The scientists are all liars. All the paleontologists, they made up these fossil records. When you go, I actually had a friend in NYU who told me, like, you know, he walked into the Museum of Natural History and he just got the sense that the whole thing was fake. He's like, how do you not have this sense? You look at this dinosaur, you just know it's fake. I'm like, well, to a certain degree, you're correct. Those bones are probably not real. Those are not real bones. They don't keep the real bones out here. But okay, so that's one position. In other words, it's a mass conspiracy on the part of the scientists, and none of it is true, and the Torah is as it was. It's pristine and should not be reinterpreted. That's a view. Another view is to say that no, the Torah is accurate, science is accurate, and we're going to have to fit the words of the Torah into science. So, for example, in the creation story, you're going to say something like, either ignore the Ramban. Well, actually, no. There's actually a couple of ways to do this. One way is to go the way of accept the Ramban, say that it's an actual description of 6 days of creation. And you can either go with something like the Gerald Schroeder theory, which is to expand those 6 days of 24 hours using Einstein's theory of relativity to say that even though it was 24 hours, it was 24 hours on the universal clock and not yet 24 hours on the Earth clock, which is a fascinating theory. I encourage you at some point, if you're interested, to read it inside Genesis and the Big Bang, the Science of God. It's very, very elegant. It's very nice. And then he kind of breaks it down and slices it up to show you how it can actually accord with different epochs. Nathan Aviezer also does the same thing.
Count time from?
Right. That's called biblical concordism. That is to say that not only does the Torah accord with it, but actually the truth is that once you understand it this way, the Torah is actually a pretty good science book. It's pretty cool, right? Because now that you know this, you can look in the Torah and you can actually start doing equations based on the Torah and come up with some interesting science. That is another way of looking at it. And then you're going to have to do that work for every single thing in the Torah. If you really are, you're a bold concordist, you believe that every single thing. And when Yechezkel makes mistakes in astronomy, you're going to have to explain how Yechezkel is really right. Okay? And he does. You're going to have to explain how he's really right and how it really all makes sense. That's the second option. The third option is what the Rambam says, which is, well, not the Rambam, what Abarbanel says, which is to say that the Torah is not a science book and it's not a history book. And there are certain places in the Torah where you simply have to say that it's not giving you science, it's not giving you history, it's giving you spirituality, it's giving you philosophy. And so when the Torah describes 6 days, it's not talking about 6 days, it's talking about the structure of the universe. That is a third option. That's a metaphorical option. It's also reinterpreting the Torah, but it's ignoring science. Not because science is wrong, because science is right, But because the Torah and science occupy different fields, Rabbi Sacks takes this viewpoint in many places throughout his books. Rabbi Sacks is a big one on this. He just says, you know, Athens and Jerusalem are just on orthogonal tracks. They don't talk to each other. They respect each other. They have a cordial relationship, but they don't talk. Jerusalem is on one path. It's talking about spirituality and morality, and science is talking about science. The last option, though, is a little bit different, and this takes us to Noach. The last option is called Dibra Torah Kelashon Belashon Bnei Adam, which says that the Torah means what it says. However, Torah was written for certain people, and it wouldn't make sense to tell the people a story that was exactly the way that science in 2018 describes the Torah, describes the world. In other words, if the Torah would start talking about how you know, lizards came out of the sea and then turned eventually into birds and then turned into apes and then turned into men, people would be like, what is this? What's going on? This is ridiculous. This is crazy. They would talk about that the way that you're talking about what the Torah actually says. For them, telling the story in this way made sense. Okay? And for example, in the case in Yechezkel, we're not going to get into it right now, when he makes a mistake, it's because he's human. And because he's describing what he sees. And so sometimes you'll find things like that in the story, and you're just going to have to explain it as the Torah was talking to a certain people at a certain time. Okay? Those are the options. I just want to say one thing. What time is it? I think we're going to save Noach for the next time. I just want to say one thing about the first Shita. The Shita of just ignore the scientists.
Scientists.
There's one practical problem, and then there's one theological problem. The practical problem is that the same people who ignore the scientists like to take rides on planes and like to use cars and like to use phones and like to fly in helicopters and like to go to doctors, you know, usually. But it's chokhmah. If you, the same science that tells you the cell phone literally uses quantum mechanics to work. It uses Einstein's theory of relativity. It uses high science. Shkoyach. But it uses real deep science. So to ignore it in one way and to accept it in the other way, I think poses an instance of cognitive dissonance. But I think there's a deeper problem. I think there's a much, much deeper problem, which is interesting to me because what I just said, I think you'll hear all the time, meaning the argument against it, that argument is used all the time against a more pure biblical literalist viewpoint, ignoring science, that's used all the time. This argument I haven't seen mentioned, but I think is a much deeper argument. And it's largely based on the Rambam, but I don't think you need the Rambam for this. Remember we learned the Rambam about miracles? What did the Rambam say about miracles, David? He said the program in the beginning. Now, why did the Rambam want to say that the miracles were all programmed in the beginning? He didn't want to say that God uses miracles left and right. Why did he want to say that? Because for the Rambam, and I'm not saying that this is everybody, and I'm not even saying you have to say this. For the Rambam, the idea that the world, as it was originally created, to work like by nature, was not good enough, and that God needed to always have the master key to just change things at a whim because the world wasn't working right, that's theologically offensive, and so the Rambam has to say it's built into the Bria. Now, almost nobody agrees with the Rambam about this, and almost everybody says that miracles happen. However, almost everybody also says that science and nature is as much an expression of God's will as the Torah is. Which is to say that if you want, on the one hand, to look at the world and say, Marabu Ma'asecha Hashem, Nifla'os Abayre, if you want to be able to say that on the one hand, you cannot at the same time turn around and say, science, science. Because if you are able to say that the world is a beautiful and orderly and systematic a creation, and it works on a level that no human could ever create and could ever manage, and that's because of God's wisdom, then you cannot turn around and say carbon dating is a farce and the bones don't exist and all of the astronomy and amazing discoveries that we make in space are meaningless. Because then, you know what you're doing? You're essentially insulting God.
There's a middle ground, which is that you say that the understanding of science is very related to the period. So, for example, if I were to say to you 200 years ago that I could talk to you like this and you'd hear me in New York, you would say, I'd say, it's science. You would think I was crazy. And you would say, science schmeins. So, I think that there's a middle ground. It's not complete nonsense.
If the argument were limited to simply saying that, look, we don't have to let it bother us because science could change. If it were limited to that, then we'd have to have a conversation. I mean, I would respect the other side. I would say, you know what? You're right. In 100 years, maybe something will come out and it'll disprove everything that we know until now. I can't say that it won't, right? However, it's not limited to that. It says that any time that there is a disagreement with the things that we discover in science versus the Torah, science doesn't matter. And I think that's an insult.
I don't think it says science doesn't matter.
God's Bria.
I think it says we don't understand either the science sufficiently or the Torah sufficiently to be able to understand what the answer is.
So then I think it also it comes from a faulty understanding of the scientific
but
method.
But how many Talmidei Chachamim are scientists? How many? How many? Name five.
I guess it depends on what you mean by scientists. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. I mean, go ask Rav Kanievsky. Rav Kanievsky says, I don't know much about science, but let's study some Torah before we go into that. That's the idea. I think that's what they're trying to say. I mean, this professor in university is going to decide what I believe in? That's not the right way to look at it. A professor, so he studies some math, so he's going to say that the world is 15 billion years old?
What else
is he saying? That there's not really a God?
No, because
he's scientific, so maybe the Big Bang is right.
So that we dealt with last time.
Instead of listening to our Afghanistan.
What we dealt with last time was that scientists make their own mistakes, and they believe that certain things are in their purview that are not.
But the Torah does not make a mistake, so who are you going to listen to? So that's what that becomes.
Good. So you have to choose one of the other options. You have to choose one of the other options and not just ignore science. You can't just ignore it. You can't just ignore it. That's what I'm arguing. You got to pick one of the other options.
The Rambam is a great example.
Yeah, and we're going to see that the Nitziv, when we get to Noach, we'll see that the Nitziv really takes this head on.
I think the science schmeins is not really. I don't think they're really the thinking people accept the science schmeins.
I can show you.
Yeah, tell me who out of the people that we respect as Jewish leaders think say Sein Schmeins?
There have been books published recently in the last decade or so by Chashuva Rabbanim, specifically during the Slifkin controversy. All right, we'll stop there. Next time we're going to look at Noach, and we're going to look at some specific arguments over there, both about science and about history. Science and Schmeins and Teira. And Teira and Torah.
It sounds like a Yiddish version of science.
Shkoyach.